and everybody has to pitch in. Now, it sounds very public-minded, and it is, but it could also be somewhat inefficient. And so the king might also need to hire mercenaries to supplement his forces. These might be local men, but they might come from overseas also. The Low Countries traditionally provided mercenaries in large numbers. For some reason, there always seems to be a manpower surplus in the Low Countries. There are people looking for work. But if you take it all together, you have the Ferd, which is the people's army. You have the Thanes. You have everybody keeping up the roads and the bridges. And you can top that off with mercenaries when you have to. Overall, it's a pretty workable system. So that's defense. But the thing that kings are defending is, of course, in a very basic sense, land. So I want to talk for a few minutes about how land works in this society, how ownership or control of land. Because the king probably spends the bulk of his time, when he's not defending the realm, the bulk of his time is devoted to questions relating to land. Ownership of land or control of land is really the only solid basis for wealth in this society. So regulating who has land is absolutely vital. Kings, for example, could confiscate land if the owner of the land does something to make the king angry. So you have to stay on the king's good side for that reason alone. But there were other problems related to land. It could be very hard to tell who really had a right to a particular piece of land. Records were scarce. This is a society that uses writing, but it uses it rather sparingly. Many times, land would change hands and there would be no written record of the transaction at all. We have some written records that survive, but they must be only the tip of the iceberg of all the land transactions that took place. Well, you might say, how did anybody know then whose land was whose? Well, you have people in pre-literate societies or minimally literate societies. They come up with methods to train their memories so that they can remember things for long periods of time. And there were a whole series of such methods that were used to help people remember the details of a land transaction. Suppose you have a guy named Wulfgar. Wulfgar wants to sell a piece of land to his neighbor, Alfstan. Now, what they might do is actually walk around the property together, describing as they go along what the boundaries of the property are. Here's the big rock. Here's the stream that divides my field from yours. Then, after they've done that, after they've both together made sure they know exactly what piece of land they're talking about, they might go to church together. And Wulfgar, the guy selling the land, might take a clod of earth from the land he's selling and put it on the altar of the church. Then Alfstan, the guy buying the land, might pick up the clod of earth and take it. And this is a symbol of the transaction. And it's meant to be remembered. Now, we know people did this because later on, when they do start writing a lot of these things down more extensively, there was kind of a transition period when people still would do the whole thing with the clod of earth, and then they would write a charter up that described the fact that they did it. So we actually have records of people doing these kinds of things. Now, there's another rather funny way that people remember that a sale of land had taken place. Sometimes the youngest person present at the sale, you know, I suppose you've got a little boy is there watching, the youngest person present at the sale would be given a big slap, a good clout on the ear. And the idea is they're going to remember that slap. They're going to remember it for the rest of their life. And they're going to remember the occasion when they got the big slap. And thus, they're going to be able to testify about the sale if there are ever any questions later on. And of course, you slap the youngest person because then you're buying the longest term of memory of the transaction. So what does this all have to do with the king? Often, though, despite all these precautions, there are problems with land transactions. People might be getting harassed by someone who claims they're the real owners of some piece of property. They might come to the king to ask for help. And the king would have to decide who really has a right to the land. And then the parties concerned after the king has made a decision, might at that point get a document drawn up, and it would prove that the king had ruled one way or the other. And this would be something that they would preserve. Such a document was called a diploma. And this is not like the diploma that you get when you graduate from high school or college. It's a more general term. It refers to a formal royal document that says, this is what I, the king, have ruled. And it might be in Latin or it might be in Old English. But there were other kinds of royal documents, much less formal ones. And they give us a really fascinating view of the king's day-to-day activities. These other documents are called writs. And these are much less formal pieces of writing. Really, they're just records of verbal orders that the king had given. And they're written usually just on scraps of parchment. A diploma can be a beautiful document, very carefully written. Writs are really kind of scrappy things. They're not really meant to be kept. You know, once the order's carried out, you don't really need to keep it. So we're lucky that we have any of these things at all. But one very interesting thing about writs is that they're in Old English. They're meant for the secular royal administration, for the king's lay officials simply to tell his men what they need to do. They're essentially memos. They might tell the sheriff of a particular county, put someone in possession of a particular estate. That's the sort of thing that you might have in a writ. So the king deals a lot with legal business of this kind. A lot of people are always asking him to do this and that for him, settle this dispute, help me with this transaction. Now, how does the king know what to do? How does he know what to decide? Well, the king is never without advisors. He always has people around him, of course. And the inner circle of his advisors is called the witan. And the word witan simply comes from the word for wise. And the word wise is related to the word for knowing, as in wisdom. So the witan are the wise men of the country who are going to give the king good advice. Now, his thanes might play this role, but he's also very likely to be surrounded by churchmen. Bishops were very often at the royal court. Important abbots are always there as well. So you really have a mixture of lay and clerical advisors. And the reason is that in this period, there's no concept of the separation of church and state. Both lay advisors and clerical advisors are equally important. And another thing that's important to know about the witan is that membership in the witan isn't fixed in stone. It's not an office that you hold. We don't have any sort of membership list of the witan in any one time. It's not as formal as that. But when there are important matters to discuss, like, for example, choosing a new king, the full witan might meet together in a formal session. And this is called the witanagemot. Such occasions are rather rare. Usually the king is just consulting his wise men, his witan, informally. But there are a few times when you want this formal meeting of all the wise men of the kingdom. That's crucial to making a big decision. So we've talked about defense, we've talked about land. Another thing that the kings are ultimately responsible for is the administration of justice. And here we see that quite a bit has changed since the early migration period. Now there's quite a lot of state apparatus for administering justice. You still do have the weregild system. People are responsible for compensating their victims if they injure them. But now the state is helping to run the system. And also a new element has entered. You can actually commit a crime against the state, or really it's against the king. And the king's justice is there to take care of that. Now, how does this system work? Well, there are courts that go along with all the different administrative levels that we talked about at the beginning of the lecture. The highest court is the shire court. The sheriff presides over the court. But the people who really run it on a day-to-day basis are the important local freemen. That is, people who are not slaves. It's understood that you have to be free to participate in the courts. And the shire court would meet twice a year to hear the most important cases in the shire. These might include cases that involved large estates, for example. that stretched over more than one administrative unit. Anything really complicated or anything perhaps politically sensitive that the people on the level of the 100 can't cope with, that's dealt with at the shire level. Below the shire courts, you have 100 courts, and these are led by the 100 men. 100 courts are really the workaday courts of Anglo-Saxon England. They meet much more frequently than the shire courts, usually every 4 weeks. They hear all cases, no matter how important or how trivial. Cases can be referred up from the 100 court to the shire court, as we've seen, but most business is dealt with on the level of the 100. So what is the law that these courts operate under? The legal system is based on ancient laws called dooms. And many of these dooms are the same legal customs we've met before. A lot of them date all the way back to the migration period. Starting from the very early days of the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms, though, kings had begun writing down these laws. This is something that became fashionable when kings converted to Christianity. It was seen as something that enhanced the king's authority. He issues a written law code. But the idea is that the kings are codifying law that already exists. It's the law of the people. They're not making new law. Now, we saw in the last lecture that King Alfred starts to tinker with this practice. He starts to change the laws a bit to suit himself. But generally speaking, the laws are seen as coming from the people. And when the king issues a law code, he's supposed to be, in effect, stating the obvious. These are the customs that we all know. Now, one way in which the justice system under the Anglo-Saxons is really different from ours is the way in which you decide if people are innocent or guilty. There are two main ways to prove your innocence. The first is called compurgation. Compurgation is when the accused swears an oath that he's innocent, and he gets a lot of other people to swear he's innocent at the same time. That's why it's compurgation. It's swearing with someone. You are purging yourself of the accusation by getting other people to swear your innocence. And the people who swear your innocence are called oath helpers. They actually help your oath along. They help make it credible. And the theory behind compurgation is obviously that it should be hard to get a lot of people in your neighborhood to swear something that they know isn't true, because they have to live there, and they don't want to be seen as liars. This is a face-to-face society. Oaths matter. So you needed different numbers of oath helpers, depending on how serious the crime was or how important the victim was. So compurgation is a kind of very formal peer pressure. Now, were there cases where people cheerfully swore things that weren't true just to help out a friend? Undoubtedly, there were. But this society is working with the tools it had. Peer pressure is one of the better things they have going for them. But besides compurgation, there's another kind of proof the Anglo-Saxons use, and this one I think is a lot better known. And I'm talking here about the ordeal. Now, you can often see references to the ordeal in books or films about the Middle Ages. The ordeal is one of the most fascinating and most controversial of medieval phenomena. The principle behind the ordeal is what you do is you get God to actually rule on the guilt or innocence of the accused. You set up a system whereby God has to give you a verdict. There are three ways to do this: the ordeal by hot water, the ordeal by cold water, and the ordeal by hot iron. Now, in the ordeal by hot water, the defendant has to plunge his hand into a cauldron of boiling hot water. Now, how far in he had to plunge his hand, that depended on the severity of the case. It might be just to the wrist. That was called the single ordeal. Or, if you were accused of something really bad, you might have to undergo the triple ordeal, in which you had to plunge your arm in all the way to the elbow. Now then you get to pull your arm out again, and then it's bandaged up, and it's allowed to heal for 3 days. And at the end of that time, the bandages are taken off, and if the blisters are healing cleanly, you're innocent. If they're festering, you're guilty. The ordeal by hot iron is very similar, except instead of plunging your hand into hot water, you have to pick up a hot iron object and carry it a specified distance in your bare hands. And then again, your hands would be bandaged, and after 3 days, you'd see how it's healing. The ordeal of cold water is in some ways the most bizarre. It's the one most often used on women. In the ordeal of cold water, you'd be thrown into a body of water, and if you floated, that meant the water is rejecting you, and you must be guilty. If you sank, then the water is graciously receiving you, and you're innocent. And this is obviously a little bit problematic. There's not a very long window of time in there between discovering the defendant is innocent and watching her drown before your eyes. But before we dismiss the whole system of ordeals as ridiculous, we need to think about what's really going on. First, the society is using all the sanctions it knew how to use to try to get at the truth when they aren't able to figure it out any other way. Remember, they don't have modern crime labs. So they make use of peer pressure with compurgation. They make use of religious awe with the ordeal, because priests participate very actively in the ordeal. There were special rituals for blessing the instruments of the ordeal, the cauldron in which they heated the hot water, the anvil where they heated the iron. Now, in addition, some scholars think the ordeal isn't really as completely hit or miss as it sounds, because when the bandages come off, and you have to decide whether the wound is healing nicely or not, it's often the local community that pronounces on whether the wound looks like it's healing well or not. And this could, of course, be a matter of opinion. Looks good to me, or no, that looks like it's full of pus. And so really what you end up getting is the verdict of the local community on the crime based on local knowledge. So really, it's the basic community verdict anyhow. But you've got a sort of a supernatural sanction for it. Well, maybe we're not going to give Anglo-Saxon justice a whole lot of credit for being ahead of its time, but the same can't be said for the money system. That was quite advanced, and it's the last major area of royal responsibility that I want to talk about. It's one of two aspects of the Anglo-Saxon economy that the kings are involved in. The other is the regulation of markets. There are actually rules for where and when markets can be held. There are certain very basic regulations about weights and measures, about not carrying out transactions without witnesses, that sort of thing. The coinage system in the 10th century is designed to meet the needs of a population that's increasingly involved in trade. The economy had expanded considerably in the course of the century. Towns are growing, especially the burghs that Alfred had founded. More and more people need coins for their transactions. That's not to say there isn't a lot of barter. A lot of exchanges get made in kind with people trading goods back and forth. But a lot of trading is also done using money, and the kings made sure to provide an excellent coinage system. And they had two good reasons they wanted to do this. The first is the kings actually earn money on the coinage. And the second reason is that coins are very convenient for paying taxes. Coinage in England dates back to King Offa in the 8th century. Offa had struck silver pennies in imitation of the pennies of Charlemagne. Remember Offa and Charlemagne, they're kind of rivalry. This starts a trend, and by the early 9th century, all the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms are striking their own coins. As the Wessex monarchy expands in the 10th century, the system gets more and more sophisticated and standardized. Here's how it worked. In the mid-10th century, under King Edgar the Peaceable, there's a big reorganization of the coinage. Every 6 years, standard dies would be issued for the silver penny, which was the only coin in circulation. These dies would be purchased by moneyers, so that makes money for the king. These were metal workers who would set up shop throughout the country. So there were dozens of individual mints, mostly in the important towns. And in these mints, the moneyers would strike coins, one by one. They were, in effect, independent contractors. Now, after 6 years, or later after 3 years, a new set of dies would be issued, and the moneyers would have to pay a fee for the new ones, and all the coins of England would be exchanged for the new issue. Over the course of the run of one issue of coins, the coins would be struck lighter and lighter, with less and less silver in them. This is so that they're going to match up with the coins that are already in circulation that have been a little bit worn. Or these coins might also have been clipped. People like to shave off little bits of silver and save them up. You're not supposed to do this, but it happened all the time. So the money system is designed to take all of these things into account. It's a very sophisticated system. And when the Normans come along in 1066, they find it difficult to keep it running effectively. The coinage system is just one aspect of an Anglo-Saxon state that I think is actually pretty impressive. Defense, justice, the economy. The English kingdom in the 10th century does a pretty reasonable job, certainly by comparison with any other state in Europe at the time. In our next lecture, we'll look at the art and learning that this stable, prosperous state made possible.
Lecture 9, The Golden Age of the Anglo-Saxons.
Welcome back. Over the last two lectures, we've watched a unified English state come into being. We looked in the last lecture at the way the kingdom was governed, and we saw that there were now pretty sophisticated mechanisms in place to defend the realm, to administer justice, and even to regulate the coinage. And this is the kind of stability you need if you want art and learning to flourish. And that's just what happened in England in the 10th and early 11th centuries. Because now the Anglo-Saxon kings and nobles have the leisure and the financial resources to patronize the arts on a large scale. Now I need to say something here about what it means to be a patron of the arts in the 10th century. A 10th century person would not have understood the term patron of the arts. In modern life, we're familiar with art for art's sake. There are museums and art galleries. They exist just because people want to experience great art. But that's not how it worked in the 10th century. When people in that period commissioned beautiful works of art, they mostly did it for the glory of God. Well, partly. And also to look impressive to their friends and maybe rivals. Human nature hasn't changed that much. But artistic patronage in our period is all about the church. So we'll spend a lot of time in this lecture talking about the church, especially about the monastic church, because the monastic church is really the driving force in the church in the 10th century. That's where the religious center of gravity is. And you'll remember that one of the reasons Alfred had commissioned translations of important texts is that he was afraid that the level of learning in the English church was too low. It was pretty tough to concentrate on learning Latin when you're worried about Vikings. But one area of the church that had suffered especially under the Vikings was monastic life. A lot of monastic communities had been destroyed by Vikings in the course of their raids, but also a lot had simply dwindled away over time due to lack of support. The lay community had other priorities during this period. You had to stay one step ahead of the Vikings. So many of the monasteries of the early Anglo-Saxon period just weren't there anymore in the early 10th century. They weren't up and running concerns. By the early 10th century, there are scarcely any monastic communities for men or women in all of England. And this was a very serious situation for the English church because the monastic life is highly respected. It tends to produce the most important intellectuals. These are the people who have the leisure to copy manuscripts and also to write new works. And monasteries have a very special status simply as repositories of holiness. Lay men and women like for there to be monasteries around because they value the prayers of the monks and nuns. It's just a good sign for the country as a whole if there are lots of monks and nuns in it. So the English kings in the early 10th century start trying to restore some of the monasteries that had been destroyed and found new ones. One of the most important of these was Glastonbury in Somerset in Wessex. Glastonbury had been the site of an ancient monastic community, but by the 930s it had dwindled away to the point where all there is left is a small school. A young man named Dunstan spent some happy years of study in this little school, but he was distantly related to the royal house, so his kinsmen pulled him away to serve at the court of King Athelstan, and he continued to do that even after he took vows as a monk. But Dunstan fell victim to a court intrigue, and he found himself in disgrace. All was not lost, though, and we get this story from a later biographer of Dunstan. It would be nice to think that it's true. Dunstan was devastated, obviously, at losing royal favor, and he was just about to go overseas into exile when the king was riding along on the top of a cliff. He's carried away by his horse. His horse bolts, and the horse is taking the king straight toward the cliffs of Cheddar. He's going to be flung to his death. And then it pops into the king's mind, perhaps he may have done Dunstan an injury. and he resolves instantly to right the wrong. The horse turns aside in time, and the king and Dunstan ride off together to the site of Glastonbury, and the king installs Dunstan as abbot and promises to give him whatever resources he's going to need to restore the community there. And this is the beginning of about half a century of very deliberate royal support for the monastic life in England. Dunstan makes a great success of his time at Glastonbury. He works very well with successive English kings. He's always managing to get them to grant even more land to the abbey. And this was really the most important job of an abbot. An abbot is sort of like a university president today. University presidents have to go solicit donations from alumni. They have to try to get grants from federal agencies. Abbots in this period have to do a similar kind of thing, only they're hitting up the king and the nobles. So Dunstan's very good at this, and people think of him as a very holy man, and the result is that Dunstan is made Archbishop of Canterbury in 957, and he holds the post for more than 30 years. He works especially closely with King Edgar the Peaceable, who rules from 959 to 975. Edgar is the greatest royal patron of monastic life in the 10th century. Now, one of the notable things about Dunstan is that he's a famous metal worker. He was an expert silversmith and blacksmith. And quite a few of the prominent religious figures of this period have some sort of special artistic competence as well, besides being monastic leaders. And Dunstan's skill with blacksmith's tools gave rise to a very famous story about him. Apparently, once he is working away at the bellows, when the devil appears to tempt him. Dunstan reacts as any quick-thinking blacksmith would. He takes his blacksmith tongs, and he seizes the devil by the nose, and he holds on for dear life while the devil howls in pain. And finally, the devil has to let Dunstan go. And this encounter between Dunstan and the devil made its way into English folklore. And there's a wonderful little English rhyme about it, and it goes like this. St. Dunstan, as the story goes, once pulled the devil by the nose with red-hot tongs, which made him roar, that he was heard 3 miles or more. So that's St. Dunstan. But I want to introduce two other monastic leaders because they're just as important in encouraging the monastic reform and the artistic patronage of the 10th century. The first of these men was St. Athelwold. Athelwold's career is very similar to Dunstan's. He starts out as an abbot of an important monastery, Abingdon in Berkshire, and then he's made Bishop of Winchester. That was a very important job in the church. Winchester was the most important town in Wessex. Now, Athelwold's special genius seems to have been founding or refounding monasteries. So in addition to being abbot of Abingdon, he also sets up new monastic communities at many sites where there had been monasteries in the past, but where the Vikings or some other factors had caused the communities to disappear. He's very active in eastern England. Of course, that's an area that suffered a lot from the Viking raids. The two most important monasteries he refounds are Peterborough in Northamptonshire and Ely in Cambridgeshire. Now, what does it mean to found or refound a monastery? What would that actually entail? First, we need to think for a moment about what a monastery needs. Obviously, the first thing it needs is monks or nuns. So you have to recruit the right people. Then you need to build a church. If there isn't an adequate one there already, you're going to need lots of other buildings, too, for the monks to live in and work in. But without a doubt, the toughest challenge is coming up with a landed endowment. These are the estates that the monastery owns that they're going to use to support the community. Now, the monastery would farm some of its land directly so that that would supply food and clothing for the monks. But they would also rent out some of the lands to earn cash so that they could buy things they needed, like altar vessels and vestments, that sort of thing. So all in all, it takes a lot of land to support a monastery. So when St. Athelwold takes on the task of founding all of these monasteries, he's going to have to gather up a lot of land. Now, we have a wonderful record of how he went about this, because the monks at Ely preserved a record of how they acquired each one of their estates, all of the different parcels of land that made up their landed endowment. Some of the lands Athelwold got the king to donate. Some was donated by other nobles. Some land Athelwold bought. And some he got out of people. by rather nefarious means. And I've got an example for you, and it concerns land owned by a guy named Oslak. Somehow Oslak got in trouble with King Edgar, and the king confiscated his lands. Remember in the last lecture I mentioned, kings can do that. Oslak asked Bishop Æthelwold to intercede for him with the king. Help me get my lands back. The bishop did this, and the king did give Oslak back his land, but he exacted a fine of 100 mancuses. Now, that would amount to about 3,000 silver pennies, so that's a big fine in the 10th century. Oslak didn't have 100 mancuses, so he borrowed 40 mancuses from Bishop Æthelwold, and he gave some of his lands as security for the loan. Things went back and forth, and ultimately, the bishop had to exert quite a lot of pressure. But ultimately, when Oslak couldn't pay the whole amount, he ended up giving the bishop a combination of cash and lands worth 40 mancuses. And once Æthelwold had the land, he gave it to Ely. So the process of endowing these monasteries could be pretty messy, because certainly Oslak wasn't left with a good taste in his mouth about this whole transaction. It could involve court politics. It could involve complicated legal maneuvers. But the result is that the monasteries that Æthelwold founded were some of the richest in England. I want to briefly introduce the third of these monastic founders, a guy named St. Oswald. St. Oswald was Bishop of Worcester and later also Archbishop of York. Oswald was of mixed English and Danish ancestry, and he was related to a previous Archbishop of Canterbury, so he's very well connected. His biographer tells us that he was very physically handsome, and he had a special love for the poor. And he apparently also had a very fine singing voice. Now, in addition to being bishop of one see and archbishop of another, he also founded some very important monasteries, including Ramsey in Huntingdonshire, which is right between Peterborough and Ely. But Oswald, like Æthelwold, is a very hard-headed businessman. We have records of the leases that he made of some of the Worcester lands. Remember, I said that you would rent out your lands so that you could have a cash income. And these leases were very sound investments. These men of God were very, very careful about the bottom line. Now I want to say something about why these three men enjoy such royal favor. Why do the English kings, especially King Edgar the Peaceable, why do they think it's so important to found all these monasteries? Well, I think it helps a little bit to think about the map of England and to think about where most of the new monasteries are. They're mostly in Mercia and East Anglia. These are areas that had been under Danish rule and that the Wessex monarchy is only now getting control of. They were trying to integrate these old Danish-ruled territories into the new unified English state, and the monasteries are one way to do that. These communities are essentially royal outposts, royal settlements, and they're going to create anchors for royal rule in these territories. That's why King Edgar is so eager to found these monasteries, or certainly that's a large part of the reason why. Of course, they're also very tempting targets. It doesn't escape the people in a place like Eastern Mercia that these new monasteries are showing up as part of a way to keep the natives from getting restless. We've already seen how the ways in which the monasteries got their land could be a bit questionable. Some of these land transactions could leave rather bitter resentments behind, and that seems to have been what happened after Edgar the Peaceable died in 975 and his young son Edward succeeded to the throne. It was as if the floodgates opened, and a lot of monasteries came under attack. A lot of old resentments showed up. This episode has become known as the anti-monastic reaction. Now, this is not really a good term for it. Nobody involved in these attacks is really questioning the premise of monasticism. They just don't like the way that particular monasteries had acquired particular estates. And for several years, things are tough before equilibrium is restored. But it's a very good lesson that the church needs the support of the king if it's going to thrive. Now, so far, I've talked almost exclusively about monasteries, and that's because the 10th century is a very monastic century in England. One of the distinctive things that develops in England in this century is the so-called monastic cathedral. So far in the history of the church, there had typically been a distinction between a monastery, which is a community for monks who do their own thing, they're praying as a community, between a monastery on the one hand and a cathedral. A cathedral is the chief church of a bishop, and it has an important role in the religious life of the whole lay community. But the monastic tide is so strong in the 10th century, this feeling that being a monk is really the best possible way to be a churchman, that many bishops set up monastic communities at their own cathedrals. Of course, many of these bishops are monks themselves. St. Athelwold does this at Winchester. St. Oswald does it at Worcester, for example, and there were plenty of others. Now, these hybrid cathedral monasteries are thus really serving two audiences, the monks within the monastic community itself and the lay congregation of the cathedrals. So the cathedrals have to look outward as well as inward. And as a result, they produce a new kind of literary text, the vernacular sermon. These are sermons preached in the vernacular, in English, rather than in Latin. You could preach in Latin to the monks, but you would want to preach in English to the laity. And they're meant for an educated lay audience of people who would come to services in the cathedral. But beyond that, they also circulated in manuscript. So there was apparently an audience of people who wanted to read these sermons on their own. And that tells us that there was, in fact, a substantial population of literate laymen, probably lay women as well. These are people who could read in the vernacular. So Alfred's efforts to broaden literacy, especially in English, really seem to have worked. Now, these sermons could be rather tough reading, in the sense that the churchmen who preach them, they're not shy about taking their flocks to task. I want to tell you about one of these sermons. It's the most famous one of the whole Anglo-Saxon period. It's by Wulfstan, who was first Bishop of London, and then he was Bishop of Worcester, and finally he was Archbishop of York. So he's a very prominent figure. And he wrote a sermon called The Sermon of the Wolf to the English. He wrote it in 1014, and that was a very bad time in England. We're going to get to this later on. But England was being attacked again by the Danes at this point, and a lot of bad things had been happening. So Archbishop Wulfstan preaches this sermon in English to try to make sense of why all these disasters are occurring. And it turns out that it's because of the sins of the English. I'm sure you're not surprised to hear that. Wulfstan lists all the terrible evils that are being done in England. Churches are robbed. Poor people are sold into slavery overseas. Lords are betrayed. It goes on and on and on in this general vein. It doesn't make really exciting reading today, but one thing about the sermon is really striking. It talks to the whole English people. It addresses the concerns of the English people of every social class. These vernacular sermons, I think, contribute to creating a sense of nationhood. In Wulfstan's sermons, you're not hearing about Wessex anymore. You're not hearing about Mercia. He's addressing the English. So one of the effects of the flowering of learning at the great churches of the 10th century is to help create a sense of an English nation. But religious literature is by no means the only kind of text being produced in the 10th century. Secular literature is also flourishing. At some point in this period, we're not sure exactly when, the greatest masterpiece of Old English literature was composed. And I'm talking, of course, about Beowulf. Beowulf is a narrative poem. It's written in alliterative verse. That means you have sounds repeating themselves within each line of poetry. There isn't any rhyme. It tells the story of the hero named Beowulf and his encounters with a series of monsters whom he slays, though at the very end of the poem he dies after killing the last monster. The events in the poem are set in the distant past, and in fact, they don't even take place in England. They're set in the pre-migration period, when the ancestors of the English had not even left the continent yet. And the poem may preserve actual traditions that had been passed down for centuries in England. The reason scholars have had such a hard time figuring out when the poem was written is that it may have taken shape over a long period of time. A lot of things in the poem look as though they should come from the 8th century. That's what linguists say, from the language of the text. But It's written down in the 10th century, and it's probably the prosperity, the spread of learning and manuscripts in the 10th century that leads it to be written down at that moment. Now, there's one really interesting thing about the manuscript of Beowulf that you might not know. We have only one medieval manuscript copy of the poem, and it probably dates from about the year 1000, give or take a few years. The manuscript ended up in the library of Sir Robert Cotton in the 17th century. He was a great antiquarian collector. He would go around England buying up as many old manuscripts as he could find. So he had this huge library, and it was preserved intact after he died. Then, in 1731, there was a huge fire in the library. And we have eyewitness reports of what happened. The chief librarian was seen staggering out of the building. He was carrying one of the most priceless manuscripts cradled in his arms. Some of the librarians actually threw manuscripts out the windows to save them. Happily, one of the manuscripts that was saved was the one that had Beowulf in it, though it's still a little singed. That's how close we came to losing the only manuscript of this incredible poem. Now, Beowulf is a very complicated poem. It's subject to many interpretations. Roughly speaking, though, I think we can say it expresses the values of the Anglo-Saxon warrior class. One of the obvious themes is the importance of doing great deeds. Beowulf comes to the hall of King Hrothgar because he knows they've got a monster problem. The problem is that Grendel the monster has been coming at night and killing people in the hall. He, Beowulf, wants to solve it. And I'm just going to give you a sample of the way Beowulf talks. This is from the superb verse translation by Seamus Heaney. And it talks about Beowulf arriving and telling the people why he has come. I had a fixed purpose when I put to sea. As I sat in the boat with my band of men, I meant to perform to the uttermost what your people wanted, or perish in the attempt in the fiend's clutches. And I shall fulfill that purpose, prove myself with a proud deed, or meet my death here in the mead hall. That's pretty stirring stuff. So bravery is very important, but the bond between a king and his followers is also very important. Beowulf is a loyal servant to his lord, unlike some, and that's definitely a good thing. Conversely, it's clearly important for a king to reward his followers well. You've got to give them treasure. King Hrothgar is praised as a ring giver. He gives rings. And jewelry in this period is seen as kind of a fungible asset. Another theme is the danger of feuds. There are a couple of very nasty ones in the poem that we find out about along the way. Over everything, though, towers the importance of reputation. The reputation of the hero. Now, there are lots of ambiguities, lots of subtleties in the poem, and they hint at some tensions in this society. Is it right for Beowulf to fight that one last monster? He's clearly too old to be exposing himself to such danger, and of course, he does die. Does Beowulf betray his responsibilities to his people by going after reputation when it's too late? Or is his death a glorious one? It's not completely clear. I think it says a lot about the sophistication of the audience in Anglo-Saxon England that we have a text like Beowulf from this period. It really is a masterpiece. Of course, it's not the only work of poetry to survive from this period. We've got a much shorter poem, but a very interesting one from a political point of view. It's called The Battle of Maldon. It's about a battle that took place in 991 between the men of Essex and a group of Vikings. This is the period when the Vikings have come back for a second great wave of attacks on England. The poem tells the story of the battle. It talks about how the Vikings sent a messenger to the English commander, Byrhtnoth, the ealdorman of Essex. They ask Byrhtnoth to pay tribute to the Vikings. Well, he hurls back a defiant reply. Tell your people the unpleasant tidings that over here there stands a noble earl with his troop, guardians of the people and of the country, who will defend this land to the last ditch. Well, that sounds great. Byrhtnoth does go to meet the Danes in battle, and he perishes. But the poem preserves his memory, And indeed, I think it was probably meant as a kind of political commentary on the state of affairs in England in the late 10th century. The poem is probably trying to say something about whether it's a good idea to pay off the Danes, whether perhaps the king needs to support his commanders in the field more effectively. Hint, hint. But I think the important thing about this poem is it suggests there may have been a lively debate about current events, and people are using this kind of literary work to engage in it. Again, evidence for quite a bit of sophisticated learning out there in the lay community. So I've talked about various kinds of texts, religious texts and secular texts that were produced in this period, but there were all kinds of other works of art that come out of the monasteries and workshops of England. I mentioned earlier that St. Dunstan is a skilled metalworker, and in fact, many leading churchmen did metalwork. We don't, unfortunately, have more than a fraction of the beautiful artifacts that must have been produced. Gold and silver objects, of course, represent capital, and they could literally be liquidated. They were sometimes melted down if the owner needed money. And in fact, we have records of churches having to do this. They might have to strip the gold and silver ornaments off of a shrine, for example, if they were short of cash. So a lot has been lost, but enough survives for us to see how stunning some of these objects were. There were altar vessels, reliquaries, bishop's croziers, that's the staff of office that the bishop carries, all sorts of beautiful objects. The churches of England must have literally shone. And probably a lot of the same motifs that we see in these metal objects were used in other kinds of carving that are less likely to survive, things like wood and ivory. I want to say a special word here about another class of artifact that we don't have a lot of surviving examples of, namely textiles. Because English textiles were very famous in this period, the fancy textiles produced in England were referred to as English work, and they had an excellent reputation throughout Europe. Some of the most elaborate garments made were liturgical vestments. A lot of these vestments included elaborate gold and silver fringes or decorative panels worked with gold and silver thread. So the monasteries were very important clients for the best embroiderers of the day. But we also have records of English queens employing embroiderers. So there must have been an extensive clientele for these textiles among the upper classes of England as well. But probably the most famous artistic works of the period are the gorgeous manuscripts. The manuscripts use many of the same motifs as you might see in the metalwork and other kinds of art. There's a lot of artistic unity in this period. The monasteries produce beautiful manuscripts of the Bible, all sorts of other liturgical texts, and they're meant to be displayed publicly in the church so that the faithful can see them and be impressed by them. And I have no doubt that they were impressed, just as we are. So what are the main points to take away from this look at art and faith in the 10th century? I think there are three. First, this is a prosperous society. It's able to devote considerable resources to artistic expression. Second, that artistic expression is mostly centered on the church. But third, there's a rather extensive lay public out there that is eager to consume works of learning and literature. And this, I think, is what makes the golden age of the 10th century different from the last golden age we looked at, the Northumbrian Renaissance of the 7th and 8th centuries. There we saw literary and artistic efforts almost exclusively centered on the church. And it's a regional movement. It's just in Northumbria. In the 10th century, a new, self-consciously English public is beginning to come into its own. But as I've already hinted in this lecture, things are about to get difficult again, because the Vikings are coming back for round two. And we'll find out what happens when they do in our next lecture.
Lecture 10, The Second Viking Conquest.
Welcome back. Last time, we talked about the golden age of Anglo-Saxon England, and we looked at the art and literature of this very rich time in English history. But we also got some hints of trouble to come. because England was going to be hit again by raids from Scandinavia starting in the 990s. We might call this a second Viking conquest of England, but it's a very different kind of conquest from the first one in the 9th century. The reason why it's so different is that England has changed and the Vikings have changed. We've seen that the House of Wessex had been able to take advantage of the Vikings knocking off the other Anglo-Saxon kingdoms. They were the last man standing, and so when it was time to reconquer England, they were the ones to do it. And that's what exactly happened over the course of the 10th century. So you have a much more unified England by the end of the 10th century, although it's a little bit different still in the north, not as well integrated into the kingdom as a whole. But things have been changing in Scandinavia too. They have also been forming more stable, unified kingdoms. When the Viking Age began, you'll remember, we saw lots of little raids by a few boats at a time. Then you start to see large groups of maybe 50 boats with one powerful, charismatic leader in charge. But what changes at the end of the 10th century is now you get Viking forces led not by individual leaders, but by kings. The Scandinavian kings are now powerful enough to lead an invasion fleet. So now you have a more unified England going up against a more unified Viking invader. Now, this is good news and bad news for England. The Vikings can't pick off English kingdoms one at a time, the way they did in the 9th century. But on the other hand, if you defeat the English king now, you've won the kingdom, or at least you've got a pretty good chance of doing that. So unity can have a downside as well. So let's look at what happens in Denmark in the 10th century that makes all of this possible. The kingdom coalesces under the reign of King Harald, surnamed Bluetooth. Another nickname we can't really explain, but it doesn't really sound very good. Harald is a canny politician. He's trying to make sure he doesn't have to worry too much about Germany to his south. So he gives some scope to Christian missionaries in Denmark. This mollifies the Germans, and he ultimately accepts the Christian faith himself. In 985, he's succeeded by his son, Swain Forkbeard, and at least that's a nickname we probably can figure out. Norway, too, has been getting its act together in the late 10th century. This is thanks to a very energetic king named Olaf Tryggvason, and he also becomes a Christian. Now, just because the Vikings are Christians now, or a lot of them are, that doesn't mean they've lost their appetite for expansion. It's just now they don't have the pagan stigma attached to them. And they can also command much more support than the earlier generation. These are much more sophisticated, much more unified enterprises, even than those big armies that were led by freelance entrepreneurs in the 10th and in the 9th century. Now, the Danish and Norwegian kings are on the rise, and England in the late 10th century is a tempting target. We saw in our last lecture England is prosperous. It's certainly in large part due to the stability that the Wessex dynasty brings. In addition, England has another very important attraction to the Danes. There are a lot of Danes in England. We saw that large parts of the country had been settled heavily by Danes in the 9th century, and those parts of England are probably bilingual throughout the 10th century, and there are certainly plenty of trading contacts and other kinds of ties back to Denmark. They're still very much in operation. And the Danes from Denmark figure that the Danes in England can act as a sort of a fifth column in England. If there's a Danish invasion of England, these English Danes might switch sides and help the invaders. So these are two very powerful reasons why the Danes might try to conquer England. It's rich, and we have fellow countrymen there who might help out. But there's another reason that may or may not have been part of the actual planning process of the Danes, but it certainly helped. The saving grace of the English in the 9th century had been the leadership of King Alfred. In the late 10th century, England does not have an Alfred. It's possible that the Danes knew this and thought it was a good time to strike. So who is ruling England? in the late 10th century. Last time I talked about Edgar the Peaceable, the king who was such a sponsor of monastic reform. He died in 975, and he was succeeded by Edward, the son of his first wife, Athelflaed. Now a wicked stepmother enters the picture. At least, that's what we get in the rumors that circulated at the time, because Edgar had married for the second time a woman named Alfthryth. By this second marriage, he had a son named Athelred. Now, Alfthryth was a very powerful woman. She had many friends at court, and naturally, she wanted her son, Athelred, to be king instead of his older half-brother, Edward. And since both boys are underage, it really turns on a faction fight between the noble supporters of each prince. And 3 years into Edward's reign, he is assassinated. He was arriving on horseback for a sort of informal get-together with his half-brother and stepmother. And at first, his brother's attendants came out to greet him. And at first, they offered the king ostentatious signs of respect. But then, they surrounded his horse, grabbed his hands, and stabbed him. Fingers pointed, naturally enough, at Queen Alfthryth. If you ask, who benefits? Well, there you are. It's not a crime we can solve this far after the fact, but I do think it's suspicious that nobody was ever punished. The consequences were momentous, though, because it meant that Athelred did come to the throne. He was too young to have been personally involved in the murder, but his whole reign was tainted by it. The nobles were split into factions. The murdered King Edward was venerated as a saint almost immediately. People called him Edward the Martyr, and that's a lot to live up to. And poor Athelred did not manage to live up to it. He's one of the most maligned of English kings. We'll meet some others. King John, for example, doesn't have a good reputation. But for sheer haplessness, you don't get much worse than Athelred. And that's certainly how his subjects thought of him at the time. Now, one thing a lot of people do know about Athelred is his nickname. He was called Athelred Unrad. Now, most of the time, this is translated into modern English as Athelred the Unready, as if he were not quite ready for prime time or something like that. But that's not exactly what it means in Old English, though I think Athelred the Unready also fits. The word rad means counsel or advice. Thus, the word unrad means no counsel or bad counsel. So the king is being called Athelred Bad Counsel. Now, this is a play on the king's name, because the name Athelred actually means noble counsel. So the king's nickname made him Noble Counsel, Bad Counsel. That's not very flattering. So how does he earn this very unflattering nickname? He earns it by failing to defeat the Vikings. Starting in 991, the Vikings return. I talked in the last lecture about the raid that led to the Battle of Maldon, at which the English commander Byrhtnoth was killed. That was part of a substantial raid led by the king of Norway, Olaf Tryggvason. You'll remember that the Viking commander at Maldon had offered to accept tribute from the English, but Byrhtnoth had stubbornly refused. Well, later that year, King Athelred does agree to pay the tribute. At any rate, this payment in 991 is the first of the payments that will become known as Danegeld. This payment turns into a tax that is collected at irregular intervals down to the 12th century, long after there are any Danes around to worry about. But apparently the English kings found it hard to abolish a tax. It was a useful form of revenue. But anyway, the payment of this protection money only bought the English a little time, because in 994, the Danes arrived, led by their king, Swain Forkbeard. Once again, the king paid them off, and again in 1002, and in 1007, and in 1012, and each time the amounts got bigger and bigger and bigger. Remember what Kipling said, if once you have paid him the Danegeld, you never get rid of the Dane. Now, you'll remember that King Alfred had paid off his Viking enemies. Why wasn't it okay for Athelred to do it? The simple reason is because Athelred lost. Alfred, is an effective commander. Æthelred isn't. And people at the time are quite aware of this. We have a very damning description of the military situation in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. That's the year-by-year record of events in England that starts under King Alfred, but it's still being added to year-by-year at this point. Under the year 1010,